I am Quentin Schultz, and I am here tonight to speak about this little book, An Essential Guide to Interpersonal Communication. I want you to know that I'm recording tonight, and I'm going to put it on my website. It's just quentinschultz.com, so if there's anyone else that you would like to have hear it, they can go there. I want to thank my co-author, Diane Badzinski. She worked with me for 5 years on this book, both of us recognizing that this was going to be, in some respects, a life-transforming book for us. I'd like to share with you six themes, and I think these six thoughts that I'll share with you are really, really important. One is that our interpersonal communication is the most formative in our lives. It forms our character. It forms our sense of identity. It forms the quality of our lives more than any other communication. You can look at mass media, you can look at social media, Facebook, Twitter, other forums, and so on. But the interpersonal communication that we're involved in day-to-day, particularly in person, is the most formative. It always has been, and dare I say, it probably always will be. So to look at interpersonal communication is to look at what's going on with people's formation, the kinds of person they're becoming in relationship to other people. Communication comes from the same root word as communion, as community. It means essentially to share or to have in common. We could say it means to have in common, common understanding. Those who have a common understanding about something have shared that common understanding. There's been some kind of communication there. Those who don't have a common understanding, even if they interact a lot about something, probably have not communicated very well. Regardless of whether or not they agree or disagree, they can agree to disagree, but know what they disagree about well and have communicated well about it. What happens in interpersonal communication is it forms how we interact with other people to form, through the relationships, community that comes back on us and shapes us as certain kinds of people. So we end up through communication, starting with interpersonal, forming community, and then the community shapes us and we become more or less like the community, however small that community is. We might not think that what we're doing up front is forming community that's coming back and shaping us, but that's what's happening all the time. It's why parents are concerned about who their kids are communicating with, right? That they may become like those kids in that peer group, in that community. I think there are three kinds of interpersonal relationships involved in interpersonal communication. One is our relationship with ourselves. Let's call that intrapersonal communication. How do I communicate with myself? This is a great mystery. We all do it. We sit around or we're driving and we're thinking about things. We're thinking about ourselves, the kinds of person we are, how we interact with other people. We're in some way talking with ourselves. And we can do this so deeply compared to other creatures, it's amazing. So we have things like introspection, retrospection about the past, and then to some extent, projection. We imagine ourselves going into certain relationships and saying certain things, and we might even fret about those things, rehearse them in our minds over and over again. All of this rich intrapersonal stuff that we engage in. So we communicate with ourselves in interpersonal communication, and we communicate with other people. I'll call them our neighbors, self, neighbor, the people that we interact with day by day, and then also with God. Those are kind of three relationships, you could say, the tri-aspects of interpersonal communication. And they come together in people's lives, but not everyone wants to take the God part of that tri-unity seriously. And I totally understand that. In fact, I have some friends that are communication scholars, excellent communication scholars, that are atheists, and a lot of them agnostics. And what they say to me is, well, okay, you're looking at this communication in terms of self, neighbor, I get that, the other, so to speak. But then they say, what about the God thing? Why introduce that complication? It's unclear what's going on there. It's ambiguous. It's a matter of personal interpretation. And all of that is somewhat true. And so the field of communication in general does not address relationship with God, except in some studies that might look explicitly at that with something like prayer. But what we tried to do in this book is to say that all three of those come together, And people have emphases in those of different kinds. And some people actually emphasize God greatly and how that relationship affects their relationship with others and themselves. Some people, even though they're believers in God, don't see that as part of the relationship. Same thing with neighbor. What you find is that some people are very concerned about themselves and how they come across. They worry about themselves, what they say, what they tweet, what they text, what they email. But they don't think so much about other people, about their neighbor. And for them, that's a different kind of challenge. But for us in writing this book, we wanted to address all three of those relationships. The purpose of this communication in forming the relationships, I think, is so that we as human beings may, in a special way, flourish. Not just communicate, not just exchange messages, not just have shared understanding, but to flourish. And I think there are ways that human beings, because of the gift of communication granted them, can flourish in relationships in a way that other creatures can't, even though the way other creatures communicate is marvelous in its own right. So communication equips us to flourish, I think, in all three of these types of relationships that are interpersonal. Second point has to do with gratitude. I think that all really great communication toward people flourishing flows internally from hearts of gratitude, from gratitude. And people tend to be divided along a continuum here. You have very grateful people on one side, and then you have very ungrateful, critical, often cynical people on another side. Of course, we're all in between there somewhere. But what you find is that the kinds of people that are grateful often are the kinds of people that we're attracted to because they're also grateful for us. And they're grateful to be in a relationship with us. One of the things I learned as a teacher that was very, very helpful in recent years was that at the end of every class to thank the students for coming. I literally would stop the class and they're getting their stuff together and I'd wait until they're all still and I would say, thank you for coming today. You honored me by coming. And I hope that something we did is truly worthwhile for you. Let me know. Every day I would thank them at the end. And some of the students after the first week or so of that would say, why do you thank us at the end of every class? It's so unusual. It's out of kilter with the way we think about what's happening. And I said, because it's not just a job. It's an honor. You honor me by coming. If there are other things you need to go to that are more important than the class, go to those. And I won't judge you as a human being based on those. But every day that you come, I'm grateful, and I'll do my best. So in all of our relationships, we can look at them as opportunities for us to apply, to act out our gratitude, or we can think of them as trouble, problems, distractions from what we ourselves want to do for our own self-interest. There is, among social media folks, that is to say those who use the social media a lot, a tendency to be more openly and publicly through these social media critical. You find a tremendous amount of criticism in social media. Some of it's just blasting away at other people, at celebrities, at something that happened to them, somebody cut them off on the street or whatever. There's a lot of criticism out there. Social media opened this up for a lot of people who have some of these feelings. At the same time, social media opened up a lot of expression of gratitude. Really, a tremendous amount. And people who may be uncomfortable expressing gratitude directly to someone else in person find that they can do it through social media. So it's really a mixed bag as to what the social media are doing in terms of people expressing their gratitude or whether or not it's making people more grateful or more critical and cynical. I think that we, in this age, very media busy age, as I'll talk about in just a minute, we all need to be able to set aside time for considering what it's worth being grateful for. And one of the reasons I took early retirement was to be able to set aside enough time, capacious time, to re-grab gratitude and eat it and swallow it and make it part of my being. Because I was getting more and more busy, and I felt like I was having less and less gratitude. not that I was being nasty to people, but I wasn't being guided by kind of a basic gratitude. And I think one of the lessons that's going to come through with social media is more and more recognition of the importance of using the social media for encouraging people to be grateful. I like to encourage people in particular, if they run across something with someone through social media that they want to express gratitude for, to do it not through that medium, but through a more personal medium, to call them on the phone, to write a note to them, to send them a personal email, so that the social media become gathering points for things we are grateful for. But then rather than just pushing out through that same medium with gratitude, we do it through something that's a little more personal and looks a little bit less just like automatic, reciprocal gratefulness, and instead is more a matter of personal, authentic gratitude. So gratitude, I think, is an important part, and it's got to come from the heart. Third is listening. I don't think there's any question among interpersonal communication scholars that listening is the most important communication skill there is. If the beginning spot is not gratitude, and there would be a lot of argument about that, though I think it should be, they'll generally agree that the beginning point should be listening, because listening is getting acclimated to reality. A good definition of listening is attending to reality, or becoming intimate with reality, the way things are, the way people are, the way relationships are, the way settings are in which we might communicate. To be aware of reality, to some extent, whatever you can, to understand it. That's listening. The opposite of a listener who's intimate with reality is the fool who doesn't know reality and moves ahead and does things, including communication, without first understanding reality. Fools cause trouble. They're in the china shops, and they're moving all over quickly because they think they've got everything together when, in fact, they don't understand reality very well at all. We're all partly fools, right? Because we get into situations or we seek out situations without first listening adequately to know what it is we're getting into. If you want a way to remember this, there's a good biblical term, an ancient Hebrew term called yada, Y-A-D-A, yada. It means essentially strong, intimate relationship, deep relationship. And when you watch a TV show or in a movie or you read something and somebody says yada, 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 what they're saying is, you know, you know, you know, you don't know. And any time you hear that, or you're saying that to yourself, I know, I know, I know, I know, you're in trouble because you don't know. Yada is the verbal filler. It's like an ah and an when we don't know what we're talking about, but without yada, it's that we don't know what reality is before we even open our trap or send a text or an email or post a photo. Becoming intimate with reality, yada, and avoiding yada, 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 or we're going to get into trouble because we don't really know. Communication is not essentially about transmission. It's not about sending messages. It's not about relaying messages. It's not about messaging in general. It's about developing intimate relationships, intimate to the extent that we need in order to really understand each other at whatever level that is in whatever interpersonal situation. Otherwise, we become fools. I had an experience with social media last year in Florida. I was in a sit-down restaurant, no drive-thru, and there was a group of, I think it was 8 high school girls. I know they were high school girls because they had high school jackets or jerseys on from the team that they were on. And they got their food. They sat down at a table. I was there for right around an hour, and they arrived about the same time. The entire time that they were there, they were texting. Not a single one of them said anything or listened to another one of them through the entire lunch period. Now, I have to be careful here because they may have been texting each other. There may have been some communication going on there. But in general, I thought to myself, this is interesting. Do they know what's going on in each other's lives or not? I couldn't make any judgment on that. but they were certainly involved in a kind of frenetic messaging that made it seem to me like maybe they were not being as relational with each other as they could be in that setting. The deepest understanding of listening that I can give you is that listening sets us up to be able to love anyone that we truly want to love. That we cannot love people in the abstract. Loving my wife as a concept of a wife makes no sense. And I need to listen enough to know her as a specific individual, a person different than all others, because then I get to know what her needs are, what her thoughts and feelings are, and I can begin to love her in a way by addressing her in her particularity. Without listening, we lack particularity, and that's especially true in interpersonal situations. And then we go ahead and say things or do other things without knowing the other person. We create conflicts, we get into trouble, misunderstandings very quickly when we don't understand what we're involved in. And listening, attending to reality, becoming intimate with reality is critically important. In the last couple of years in the psychological literature, they have proven, I believe, that multitasking, intellectually or cognitively, brain multitasking, is a myth. It's a myth. Yet we use this term multitasking all the way with everything, right? I mean, it's everywhere. It's as if it's a good way of life to multitask. It's a positive thing. It's a sign of a kind of skill. Well, there are people that I know who, as writers, can listen to music and write at the same time, and it works fine. But they don't have two cognitive things going on unless they're really trying to listen to the music. The research shows is that as soon as we start shuffling back and forth between two different cognitive things, we don't do either one as well. And over time, what we think we have actually accomplished intellectually, we have not. And we have to be able to focus on a single thing at a time. And I believe we have to focus on a single individual at a time, too, as well, in order to get to know them, to love them, and avoid being fools. A fourth point has to do with cross-generational communication. By cross-generation, I mean, let's say, between parents and children, or grandparents and grandchildren. Cross-generational. Okay. Cross-generational communication among human beings has always been essential for right living. For right living. I say this because wisdom gets passed along from generation to generation. It's almost impossible to create wisdom, let's say really wise living, right living, the kind of living where you know what to live by. It's almost impossible to create that from scratch. It has to be passed along. And I think in the age of social media, it is especially not going to get passed along because of the busyness, the messaging, the rapid messaging, the incredible involvement we have in all of these things going on around us in different relationships. I grew up in the Chicago area, and on the northwest side near O'Hare Airport where I grew up, they put the first McDonald's franchise. Not the first McDonald's restaurant, but the first one in the franchise. They later put the 1,000th one there when I was in high school. That's another story. I'm talking about the original one. When I would look up at the sign, it would say 5,000 sold or 6,000 sold. Wow, they sold 6,000 hamburgers at McDonald's. And my brother, who is 9 years older than me, got a car when he was 16. It was either white over pink or pink over white. I can't remember. But he had it painted royal blue, had moon hubcaps put on it. It was a hot car. And occasionally, he would say to me, "Quinny, do you want to go for a ride to Max, to McDonald's?" "Yeah, Lou, yeah, I want to go." Get in the back. Couldn't be seen in the front with him. That was not cool to be a young teenager, so I would sit in the back seat. He would be in the front driving. The back seat was really low. I could barely see over the windows. We would drive up north into McDonald's, and then before turning in, he would take a look across. There was no indoor seating, very little outdoor seating. Everybody went to their cars or stood around cars if the weather was good. And he would go in and make one loop around the parking lot, because that's the only loop you could make, that one little loop, a few spots there, and he would figure out where his friends were. then he would pull back in and park near the group that was his friends or that he wanted to be his friends. Then he would say, stay in the car. He would get out, and he would go over in another car, or he would stand outside with these people that were his friends or want to be friends. And I don't know what they talked about. All I knew is that it was important. And one day I would be of the age where I could listen into that stuff, and I really wanted to, but I was excluded. And they would get something to eat, and he would go on like this for who knows how long, and I'm very impatient, and I'm getting to the point where I have to go to the bathroom and everything else. And he would come back to the car, say, okay, we're going to go. And then we would pull out a little bit to the parking lot end where it would turn on to Lee Street, a major street through town. And as soon as he made that turn, he would put the hammer down on that V8 and lay about 20 feet of rubber. And then as soon as we got past that, he would turn the radio on. WLS in Chicago, Dick Biondi. The only station at that point, I believe, that was playing music aimed at his generation. What he did back there in that parking lot with his friends was Facebook. He was interacting in person with these people, and he was getting there through transportation rather than communication, and that later gets transported to the phone, to the internet, to computers, to Facebook and the like. But there were ways where young people could get together in person and say those things in person that they wouldn't necessarily want to say publicly. Some of them they would. When he turned that radio on, he was listening to a radio station oriented toward his generation. I remember two kinds of commercials on that radio station that I would listen to because he was listening to. One was for pizza. The other was for acne medicine. And one created a demand for the other, I found out years later. But the point I'm making to you is that there is a long history after World War II of the development of youth-oriented media and the cultivation of intra-peer communication, interpersonal communication, peer-to-peer-to-peer in groups, one way or another. And what happens eventually with social media has its predecessors, with young girls, it was sleepover parties and everything else. But with the media, and with social media now in particular, there is much more of a kind of narrowing of the communication within the peer group. So the peer group now, within a generation, is not a full generation. You can have brother and sister who are 4 or 5 years apart in age, and they listen to different music. They listen to different radio stations, if they listen to radio at all anymore. They view different television programs. They go to different websites. They have different groups of friends that they post messages to. The good sign in social media is that there is research in recent years that some young people, through social media, find out what's happening with older generations and their families. They take an interest in that. And they connect, often initiated by young people. Not so much with parents, but especially with grandparents. And I think one of the benefits of social media is this cross-generational communication between younger people and grandparents. And this is more so with women, by the way, than with men. And communication cross-generationally between a father and a son is really in bad times. We're talking about minutes at most communication per day in a typical family where the son still lives at home. And the social media don't seem to be helping with that a lot, but they do seem to be helping significantly with cross-generational communication, female to female. A fifth point is what I call media fit, picking the right medium for the right purpose, the right medium for the right purpose. I'm not the kind of person who thinks that any particular medium is inherently bad and we should just get rid of it, or any particular technology. And yeah, I'm on Facebook, but I've whittled down the number of friends to a very small number because I couldn't deal with all of the chaos, all the messaging and the busyness and so on. I needed to get it down to a smaller group that I could manage and follow and know what in the world was going on with them rather than feel like I was just hopping in and out of one little bit of a relationship after another. That's how I worked with that one, but I didn't feel like Facebook is worthy of getting rid of completely. And my wife can always fill me in on the broader situation with other people, if need be, because she follows that broader than I do and is willing to fill me in on what's going on. the right medium for the right purpose. What's right if you need forgiveness, if you're seeking forgiveness? What's the right medium for that? What if the person is close or lives far away? What do you do with that? What do you do with dating? What do you think about online dating? I have an interesting thing that I've done with my students in recent years where I ask them on this question of media fit or fittingness. I say, now, if you had an opportunity after two dates you're really liking somebody and you want to get together personally, would you rather do it in medium A, B, C, D, and I give them a bunch of choices, including social media, and then I say, or on a warm summer day being at the beach together. Bam, that's it. I say, why is that? What is it about being in person, or in a sense being incarnate with another person, that's so special? It's the face-to-face. It's the voice-to-voice in person. It's the possibility of touch. It's such a fully orbed kind of communication in person. And it's hard, even with something like Skype, which is being used widely by boyfriends and girlfriends and fathers and granddaughters and all of this talk with other people. It's great. They can see each other to some extent, but it's still not quite as robust as in person. Well, so we have all of these different media, and we have different communication purposes, all of which could lead to greater flourishing. But each day we're faced, if we're open to it, with decisions to make. What is the appropriate medium for this? I have a great relationship with my son. He's 35, but they live on the East Coast. And I find that what's happened in the last couple of years, because we can Skype and we can stay in better communication with each other, and have, I hope, the kind of father-son relationship that's really robust and good and we're both flourishing in it, what's happened is I want more of it. And then I thought to myself, you know, I would not be feeling that way if I hadn't gotten a taste further along with him with Skype, let's say. Because that makes me want to get together with him in person even more, even though it's more robust than just talking him on the phone or texting during the day or whatever. So we have limited time. We have limited resources of all kinds. How do we make these decisions about which medium is the best for a given communication purpose? I get dismayed with some of this. I read in the paper about somebody laying off somebody else, firing them through email, never meeting with them in person. It doesn't seem to me to be the right fit. But what is the right fit on the more intimate interpersonal stuff? Is online dating a good thing? Boy, I know people that have met people through online dating things and it's worked out marvelously. I know people that grew up together through high school and they got divorced in college or later. There's a lot of mystery in all of this, but it still seems to me that the question of fit is critical, and we need to ask ourselves that because of the number of different possibilities. The sixth and my last point really is about encouragement. Encouragement. From what I can tell, the greatest, certainly one of the greatest, needs that people feel in the age of social media is for very basic encouragement. No matter how well connected people are with other people, how much messaging they're involved in, there is a tremendous amount of discouragement. There are plenty of reasons for this beyond just, let's say, having a lot of media at your disposal. There are economic reasons for it. There are difficulties in relationships that are partly of our age, of people opening up and realizing they could be a different kind of person than what they thought before, and finding out about things and lifestyles and ways of life and all that they never had any notion about, and different cultures that they would like to be connected with, and groups maybe that they grew up with, and ethnic groups or racial groups that they begin to identify with. And this begins to shift all kinds of stuff around in their self-identity and then their relationship with other people. And it makes a lot of our interpersonal relationships seem to be very tenuous. And when that happens, people get very fearful because they don't know how best to interact with other people. They fear doing something, saying something, or even listening to certain people. Because if they believe that those people they're listening to, whether in the media or in person, social media, may be offering things to like or to love when they're not sure that they should, they may turn that off. I've been teaching media criticism in recent years, and I can tell you that the need for media criticism among college students is greater than ever. So many students are absolutely lost out there with what to do with all this different stuff, especially all of the identity messaging. Who are you? How do they fit that with themselves? And so much of it seems to challenge what they've assumed about themselves and what they grew up with. They don't know what to do. They're fearful. I understand that. We all need encouragement to move ahead, to risk things for the sake of good relationships, to risk some things to move toward flourishing. There may be rejection. There may be nasty things. Bullying, gossip, flattery that you find later to be real flattery and totally untrue. Broken promises. There are a lot of reasons to become discouraged in this kind of environment. Encouragement means to really help each other take heart and to give heart. It means to give somebody the courage at the heart level to move ahead in life. I find this with my mentees, my former students and many other people who are mentees of mine over the years. And about 20% of my time is mentoring, and there's so much discouragement. A big part of my job as a mentor in this great age of social media is to monitor what's going on and then to encourage people through it all. Some of it they'll contact me personally, some of it I'll pick up from other people. Encouragement would seem to be the easiest thing to offer someone. And there's a lot of it that seems to be offered through social media. But in face-to-face interaction, it is amazing how little encouragement there is. And I think that partly what's happened is that social media have become a place where people think that they can be encouraging with others and it's sufficient. And they may not move toward that personal, more strongly interpersonal relationship to more, I believe, a little more deeply from the heart to give that encouragement. We need to give each other heart, otherwise we all lose our courage. I'd like to read just a very brief section on encouragement. We devote a whole chapter to encouragement in the book. In fact, the first chapter is on gratitude. And we say in there, the missing first chapter in every book on human communication is a chapter on gratitude. At any rate, on an encouragement, we say, we encourage the hearts of others by giving them the courage they need to go on in life, even in the midst of frustration, hardships, and disappointments. We encourage people by giving them the hope and confidence they need for daily living as well for a specific, more challenging situation. An abused wife needs the courage to speak up to her husband and to those who will stand beside her as she seeks to stop or escape from the abuse. A depressed friend needs courage to keep going in dark times. Think of encouragement in terms of verbal and nonverbal support for our neighbors in need, which includes just about everyone we know and interact with. We can try to live independently, but we can't flourish without neighborly encouragers. We will flourish only when we receive lots of loving encouragement. The message of support is take heart, you're not alone, I am with you. Encouragement. So, by way of conclusion, how do we move forward in a remarkable age where we have more means of messaging? How in the world do we move forward in this? And I feel a little bit like a dinosaur myself. I can't possibly understand all the different ways of communicating with people now, but I can take a few of them. And in those, within the limits of what I think I can do, I can help people to flourish. I can set aside the time to be grateful enough that when I enter those arenas, I am motivated by gratitude rather than critical, cynical attitude. I can have enough time, and I hope enough heart to listen to others without first speaking. I can engage here and there in the kind of cross-generational communication that we need because I put some reasonable limits on things. I've made some tough decisions on what I can and can't do. And I've tried to seek out some wisdom from other people who have been through this, including younger people. So I do ask younger people, should I be in this medium? Should I be using this technology, this app? What do you think about that? You may be younger than me, but you may have a little more wisdom on that than I do. Help me. I need discernment, especially to know what's fitting. for a given purpose. And I'll take that discernment from anywhere I can get it. There is a wonderful expression in the monastic tradition. It's very biblical, but it's carried through all over by many, many different people in many, many contexts. And the expression is, speak only if you can improve upon the silence. I take that to be deep wisdom. And I spent quite a bit of time speaking, so with that, I'm going to move towards silence. Thank you.